On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman is convicted of fatally poisoning her husband.
Anytime a spouse is murdered under mysterious circumstances, first the wife and then any other family members become the primary suspects.
On the one hand, I'm dealing with losing my husband. On the other hand, there's all these questions about what happened.
Then Shelby Carano tells her story. She was found guilty in the heroin death of a sex client.
He had tracks up and down his arms. When he said, "I want to do another one," I didn't even second guess it.
I said, "Boy, you've done it this time. They're going to make an example of you, Shelby."
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Diane Fleming and Shelby Carano. On June 12, 2000, 37-year-old Chuck Fleming was rushed to the emergency room after exhibiting severe flu-like symptoms. Within 2 days, Fleming was dead. The lab results revealed he suffered from methanol poisoning.
It was just a lot to absorb, you know, all at one time.
Police focused their investigation on the Fleming home, viewing Chuck's wife, 43-year-old Diane Fleming, and her 24-year-old son, Chucky, as suspects.
They start, you know, saying that they thought that someone did this deliberately. All their questions were more leaning towards Chucky.
She did what she did as a mother protecting her son, not as a killer trying to hide her own guilt.
With little forensic evidence tying Diane to the crime, the state's case was entirely circumstantial. And some people question whether Chuck Fleming's death was murder at all.
The so-called smoking gun was the methanol in the bottles. If you can explain that another way, which you can scientifically, there's no smoking gun.
There was methanol in the bottles, and there was deceitful behavior on her part. There's a Latin phrase, false in one, false in all.
Did Diane Fleming fatally poison her husband, or was she falsely convicted of a crime she didn't commit?
My parents were both from Fredericktown, Missouri, and they moved back there when I was 4 and a half.
Fredericktown is a small rural area. We've got like 4,000 people.
My grandfather had some horses and pigs and cows, and it was really like growing up on a farm.
When Diane was 6, her sister Donette was born.
She used to sew Barbie doll clothes for me, and it was her job every morning to brush my hair.
Diane attended Fredericktown High School, where she excelled in her studies.
I was a real good student. I hung around with a group of good kids.
But the kid she hung around with the most was her high school sweetheart, Charles Ellinghouse.
He was very studious, very smart. They dated most of their high school years.
Diane worked at a local drugstore and intended to go to college to become a pharmacist. But her plans were derailed during her senior year when she discovered she was pregnant.
I always feel like she was wasting what she had because I felt like she was very smart and needed to be going on to school and getting her career established. But she was in love.
In February 1976, Diane gave birth to her son, Charles Jr., who went by Chucky. But in 1979, after 4 years of marriage, Diane and Charles divorced.
I wasn't mature enough. I still wanted to go out, you know, with my girlfriends.
When I got married, she was my maid of honor. The best man was my husband's cousin, and they hit it off pretty good.
In January 1981, 4 months after Donette's wedding, Diane married Charles Tanner, a Marine. She and Chucky moved with her new husband to Northern Virginia, where he was stationed. The following year, Diane had another son, Jeffrey.
I had a good childhood.
We're a close family for the most part.
But not long after Jeffrey was born, Diane's marriage to Charles began to fall apart. They separated in 1986.
My father has anger management issues.
He had a very bad temper. Chuck was a bad choice.
By 1989, 3 years after separating from her second husband, Diane was ready to date again. She placed a personal ad in the local newspaper and got a response from another man named Charles, Charles Fleming.
I called him and said, I no longer date men named Charles. Chuck got a laugh out of that. He persuaded me to go out with him anyway. We hit it off.
In March 1990, Chuck proposed and the two moved to the Richmond area where he had gotten a job as a maintenance mechanic at a tobacco company. They were married in September and Diane's sons, Chucky and Jeffrey, moved in with them. There were growing pains from the start between Diane's oldest son and his new stepfather.
He really cared about my mom and my brother and me, but my brother and Chuck really didn't get along.
He and Chuck locked horns frequently, because I think being 14 and getting a step-parent must be really hard.
There were quite a few pretty serious altercations between Chuck and Chucky.
On three different occasions, over a period of a few years, the police, you know, had to come.
He was actually arrested and taken to juvenile court at one point. The other two incidents were much more minor.
The tension was temporarily put aside when Megan joined the family in 1993.
The day my sister was born was the happiest day of my life and the happiest day of my mom and dad's life.
Diane describes the next few years as enjoyable ones for her family, but in 1996, she grew concerned about her husband's activities.
He went to work, came home. So when that behavior changed, it wasn't hard to figure out that something was going on.
Diane suspected Chuck was having an affair with a coworker who she claims had been pursuing him.
I had complained about her calling, and I didn't trust her. I checked her house and, you know, saw him there. So I just knocked on the door until he answered, and that was when it all, you know, blew up.
Chuck did have an affair. He confessed that had been going on. And it was really hard on my mom. They were able to make it work because they both loved each other very much, that and the kids.
I think he realized, too, that he had a lot to lose. And that was it, and we were fine after that.
Put that behind them, bought a new house in a nice subdivision. There was really no indication that the affair was still an issue.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
He was in the hallway bathroom on his hands and knees. That's when I knew this isn't the flu. This is something more.
By 2000, 43-year-old Diane Fleming and her third husband, Chuck, had weathered a rough patch in their marriage when Diane caught Chuck in an affair with another woman. When that was resolved, they bought a new home in Midlothian, Virginia, a suburb of Richmond. 37-year-old Chuck continued to enjoy a passion for basketball, as well as an interest in fitness.
Chuck had one of his home gyms, the treadmill. We work out every day.
He was trying some protein shakes, vitamins, because his muscles weren't cut.
Chuck did all the wrong things for himself. You should hydrate when you play sports. Instead, he would drink Diet Coke. You're supposed to refrain from alcohol. He would drink alcohol.
He started talking about this creatine he wanted to try. So I thought, well, here's another phase.
Creatine is an over-the-counter bodybuilding supplement used by some athletes to help increase muscle mass.
A lot of bodybuilders use it, but he didn't take care of himself. He thought the medication, the creatine, would actually do that for him.
After church, Chuck had wanted to get this creatine stuff, and we had talked about what to mix it in. So we picked up a case of the 20-ounce bottles of Gatorade. I got the mixing spoons out, and he said 1.5 tablespoons. And I put those in, he put it in the refrigerator, and he went to play basketball. He came home about 6:30, and he drank the first bottle of the Gatorade mixture. And again, went through the same ritual. We're standing there talking, mixing it up. But it said 1.5 teaspoons. And I said, you said tablespoons. It says here teaspoons. And he said, that's okay, more is better.
Diane says Chuck went to bed early that night without eating much dinner. The next morning, he got up for work and complained he was not feeling well.
I heard him groaning and making sighing noises. I said, well, don't go in if you, you know, don't feel good. No, no, he never missed work. So he went on to work.
My mom and I took my sister to school that morning. We passed my stepfather coming back towards the house. We get home, he was laying on the couch. He'd been throwing up at work.
I asked him if he wanted to go to the doctor. He said, no, no.
One point, I had come downstairs and he was in the hallway bathroom on his hands and knees, just getting sick. That's when I knew this isn't the flu. This is something more.
About 5:30, he said, I'm having trouble breathing. I talked him into letting me call the rescue squad. They seemed to think that he was dehydrated from vomiting all day.
My stepdad couldn't breathe, he couldn't see. And that's when the paramedics took him to the hospital.
The ambulance rushed Chuck to Chippenham Medical Center, where his condition quickly deteriorated.
The doctors really had no clue what was going on with him.
He wasn't making a lot of sense. They said, what is he ingested? Well, of course, I told him about the creatine. A kidney specialist was called in. They kept asking me if he could have taken an overdose of aspirin. I said, no, he was no longer conscious. About 7 or 7:30 in the morning, the doctor called and told me that the tox screen had come back and that it was methanol.
Methanol is a chemical compound often used as a laboratory solvent to make other chemicals, including automotive fuel.
When they suspected that he was poisoned with methanol, one of the antidote of methanol is ethanol, so they gave him ethanol.
At some point during that long day, they were just saying it wasn't working, and it was just a nightmare.
On Wednesday, June 14th, the doctors told Diane they suspected Chuck had been deliberately poisoned. Detectives with the Chesterfield County Police Department met Diane at the hospital.
The doctors are telling me that he's deteriorating, and I had to actually leave his bedside that afternoon to go with the police back to the house so I could show them where any chemicals were kept.
They went out in the garage. The only thing they found that had methanol in it was the gallon of windshield washer fluid, unopened, full. Diane opened the refrigerator and pointed to the bottle and said, this is one that Chuck mixed that's still in the refrigerator.
The evidence technicians took the Gatorade and creatine mixture from the home refrigerator. They also found 3 more bottles in Chuck's office, 2 in the refrigerator and 1 partially empty bottle at his desk. Diane returned to the hospital.
By this point, the doctors were telling me they had done a CAT scan and saw a huge brain hemorrhage that they said no one could have survived. It was just surreal, you know, that somebody that came in with symptoms that seemed like dehydration. His family and I were going back and forth about, do we leave him on life support? I called Pastor Rupar and said, do you have anything like a last rites? So we were able to do that before they actually discontinued life support.
A memorial service was held for Chuck Fleming on Saturday, June 17th. He was 37 years old.
It was a beautiful service. My mom and I we broke down. You could tell she was falling apart.
On the one hand, I'm dealing with losing my husband. Then on the other hand, there's all these questions about what happened.
According to the autopsy report, Fleming's cause of death was acute methanol poisoning. The police investigation ramped up, and in late June, Diane and her two sons took polygraph exams.
That was nerve-wracking. We were suspects. We each took the test 3 times, and we both passed with flying colors.
Her son, on the other hand, Chucky, he did not pass his polygraph.
Diane started to worry that police were viewing her son as their number one suspect.
Detective Baker was sitting in our living room. Chucky was on the computer. She was asking, is that the computer that people use for internet access? Chucky has this like thing for horror movies, and there's like a lot of websites that he would frequent. I didn't want them to see these horror sites and think, ooh, this is a weird kid, you know? They already had the previous incidents of the police, the altercations. So I switched out the hard drive.
Next up on Women Behind Bars.
There was a bottle with methanol in it still at the house. So that's a tough one to get around from the defense standpoint. You wouldn't expect methanol to be at the house if it had been ingested at work.
And later,
the phone rang. It was the police. I was thinking I was getting ready to go to jail for prostitution. Boy, was I wrong.
On June 14th, 2000, 37-year-old Chuck Fleming died in a Richmond hospital 2 days after falling ill from flu-like symptoms. The medical examiner ruled the official cause of death as acute methanol poisoning. Chuck's wife, 43-year-old Diane Fleming, was devastated by her husband's death and concerned the police were targeting her son, Chucky.
Anytime a spouse is murdered under mysterious circumstances, first the wife and then any other family members become the primary suspects. At first, a lot of the attention was on Chucky. It was pretty clear that Chucky and Chuck did not get along well.
When the lab results showed that methanol was present in all 4 Gatorade bottles taken from the Fleming home and Chuck's workplace, police concluded that someone had deliberately spiked them. Diane claimed she had no idea there was methanol in the bottle from her kitchen refrigerator.
I wouldn't have given it to them. I would have had 2 days to have disposed of it. I most certainly wouldn't have left it there where anyone, including my daughter, could have drank it.
The only source of methanol found at the Fleming home was the unopened bottle of windshield wiper fluid in the garage. Investigators also learned that pure methanol was accessible at the plant where Chuck was employed.
They have jugs of it just laying around. Pure methanol.
He's a supervisor. He could have easily made someone mad.
Despite the pure methanol at the workplace, Diane says the police seemed to focus solely on the home and her son. Authorities also found an internet search for methanol poisoning had been made on the family computer on May 15, 2000, nearly 1 month before Chuck's death.
The expert admitted that the clock could have been wrong. It could have been misset. On the other hand, there wasn't anything to suggest that it wasn't the right time.
That was in June, not May, that Diane made the search.
I was researching methanol poisoning from the moment he was diagnosed.
On July 16th, 2001, Diane claimed that she was surprised when she received news that a grand jury had indicted her for the murder.
Well, we were all flabbergasted because it was the whole focus of their investigation had been directed toward Chucky.
There was evidence that from the time that they went and got the creatine and the Gatorade bottles, Chucky had been at work. There really wasn't any direct proof that Chucky had done something.
Without evidence to link Chucky to the crime, Diane Fleming was charged with first-degree murder and adulteration of a food substance.
They arrested her right there in the driveway. They put her in the car and drove away.
Diane spent 8 days in jail before being released on bond.
I was totally confident that this was just something I had to go through.
The state's evidence against Diane came down to two key points, the first being the methanol found in the Gatorade bottle in her home.
There was a bottle with methanol in it still at the house. So that's a tough one to get around from the defense standpoint. You wouldn't expect methanol to be at the house if it had been ingested at work.
But there was no forensic evidence that the methanol in the Gatorade bottles came from the windshield wiper fluid in the garage.
Diane's attorney asked the toxicologist, even if Chuck had drunk all of the bottles, was there enough chemicals in the drinks to kill him? And the answer was no, there wasn't enough, even if he drank all of them.
And there was no definitive explanation as to why there was methanol in the bottles. The second key point revolved around the family's computer hard drive that Diane destroyed months earlier.
Prosecution kept saying she destroyed evidence, and the defense kept saying she didn't have any reason to think that it was going to be evidence.
Diane claimed she removed the hard drive in order to protect her son. She said she gave the drive to a friend, then later retrieved it and threw it away. But her friend told a different story on the stand.
She said that Diane had taken the hard drive out because she didn't want to appear to be a jealous wife.
Diane denies this and says she wanted to search through a document that was password protected in hopes that it might solve the mystery of Chuck's death.
And the friend of Diane's testified at trial that Diane didn't want the police to find some kind of software that she used to break in to Mr. Fleming's emails. That was pretty damaging evidence, coupled with the hard drive itself.
Diane's demeanor in the courtroom did not win any points with the jury either.
She was clearly uncomfortable talking about the places where she'd been deceitful. When you admit that you lied, it hurts your credibility on the key issue.
My doctor put me on Zoloft for depression.
That really puts you in a fog.
Not a word was ever mentioned during trial that she was on this medication.
On the morning of February 20th, the second day of the trial, the jury retired to deliberate. After 2.5 hours, they returned with their verdict, guilty on both counts.
When they said guilty, I had to think, did I hear that right? This is a mistake. It's going to get straightened out.
My mom had no reason to kill Chuck.
The circumstantial evidence was as weak as it possibly could have been. So it's very surprising that the jury found her guilty.
In September 2002, Fleming entered Fluvanna Correctional Institution in Troy, Virginia to serve her 30-year sentence.
Coming to prison, my appeals were still going on. I really didn't think I would be here that long.
In 2007, Dr. Muhammad Ali Albayati, a renowned toxicologist and pathologist, did an independent review of the Fleming case. His findings were published in 2008.
Chuck was taking about 10 medication, causing creatinine to be absorbed to the kidney, causing kidney toxicity.
Albayati stated the methanol traces in Chuck's blood were a false positive, and the subsequent treatment led to his fatal brain swelling.
The medical evidence clearly show that he did not die as a result of methanol intoxication, and also show he did not ingest methanol on June 11, 2000 and June 12. Diane is innocent.
It was a misdiagnosis. What killed him was the brain hemorrhage. If they had gone in, you know, stopped the bleeding, probably he could have been saved.
Some feel that Dr. Albayati's findings are not strong enough to overturn Diane's conviction.
The problem with that theory is there was still methanol where it shouldn't have been. All the symptoms were he died of methanol poisoning.
Whether or not the traces of methanol found in the Gatorade indicate that the bottles had been deliberately spiked remains a point of contention. For Diane Fleming, the separation from her kids is the most difficult part of being in prison. Her daughter Megan is being raised by Chuck's parents.
Because she was mommy's girl, you know? I've not seen Megan for 2 years.
When my mom first went to prison, it was really hard on me. I mean, even still to this day, it's hard for me to go see her.
Diane lives on the honor wing and works as a teaching assistant.
I'm a tutor and administrative aide in the printing class where women can take vocational training. That's really been one of the best things.
She continues to maintain her innocence and has a loyal group of supporters working on her behalf to get her a new trial.
Diane has been stripped of her freedom, but there's three things that Diane has not lost. That is her faith, her dignity, and her pride.
Don't ever assume that if you lead a law-abiding life, that something like this can't happen to you. But I still am confident that it's gonna work out.
Next up on Women Behind Bars, a dose of heroin turns deadly.
I always had the golden rule of I didn't get high with customers. If I'd have stuck to that rule, I would not be sitting in this chair today.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to WeTV.com. In the late night hours of December 11th, 2003, 43-year-old Stanley McMillan was found dead on the floor of a motel room.
The autopsy showed that he did indeed die of an acute heroin overdose.
Phone records led police to 38-year-old Shelby Carano, a prostitute who had been with McMillan earlier that evening.
I laid it down on the table. I told him, yes, I was there. This is what we did. Couldn't believe he was dead.
Shelby, a longtime drug addict, admitted shooting heroin with Stanley, but claimed he was alive when she left the room.
They attempted to make it appear as though the entire incident was her idea.
Was Shelby Carano responsible for administering the lethal injection that killed Stanley McMillan? Or is she paying the price for a grown man's choice to use drugs?
I spent my younger years living with my parents on Williamsburg Road. I can remember my father coming in on his motorcycle in the evenings, and I would be at the door, you know, the daddy's girl.
I could tell she was going to be a very pretty girl. She had a great personality.
She liked animals, and she always liked horses.
When Shelby was 7 years old, her parents decided to separate.
From that point on, things kind of went downhill. You know, the broken home syndrome.
I just told her me and her dad couldn't get along anymore. She said she wanted to stay with her father.
I raised her the best I could, but, you know, me being single, trying to raise a child, she got a little wild.
My father loved me very much, but at the same time, he didn't have enough time for me. So I ended up spending a lot of time with my aunt.
Shelby visited her Aunt Nida on weekends. She says Nida was disabled and a lonely alcoholic who enjoyed having her niece drink with her.
My first drink was probably at the age of 9 or 10. And Nida was the one that would give it to me. It wasn't about the alcohol for me, it was about trying to make her happy.
Her aunt would sell her body for money because she was crippled. Everybody kind of felt sorry for her.
Nobody ever knew that we were drinking fifths of liquor on the weekends and eating Valiums like candy. By 9, 10, 11, I was probably a full-fledged alcoholic, and it progressed.
At 14, Shelby went to live with her mother, But by this point, she was out of control.
There was one issue after another. She wouldn't go to school.
She really tried to keep a tight hand. But if your kids want to be bad, they're going to find a way. And I partied. I hung out with all the bad kids.
In 1981, 16-year-old Shelby quit school and left home.
Shelby went to work. I don't know if that was a good thing or not.
Shelby lived with various boyfriends and worked at a fast food restaurant and in a warehouse, but she was not satisfied with her meager income.
I got a job working at a little bar called Flips. I waitressed there. They had dancers. They had talked me into getting to a couple of the wet t-shirt contests, and I won the money. That's all it took was once or twice to get that taste of money, and I started dancing.
Hitchhiking to work one day, Shelby met a guy whom she began dating.
He was good to me. And the reason why we got married was because I got pregnant.
In September 1986, Shelby gave birth to a baby boy. Despite her joy at being a mother, Shelby started using cocaine.
It was really my first exposure to hard drugs. And it was fun for a while, but we were doing way too much.
The drug use added problems to an already troubled marriage.
Deep down inside in my heart, I just wanted to be a good mom, but it's impossible to do when you're getting high. So I put ultimatums, you know. You gotta pick me or the drugs. He got in a truck and took the dog and left. And that was how our marriage ended.
She loved her son. And she was a good mom. She really was there in the beginning. And then she moved to Southside. That's where a lot of drugs are at. She just got more involved in them, deeper and deeper.
It was a whole new world of drugs. That was my first taste of crank. That escalated into meth. When the meth ran out, I went to coke.
Once the drug gets a hold of you, it just turns your life upside down.
Shelby lost custody of her son because of her drug addiction, and in 1992, she was arrested for cocaine possession.
I got 4 years. I did 10 and a half months and got out on parole. And when I got out, I just wanted to stay out of jail and do the right thing.
After landing a job dancing at a club in Richmond, Shelby ran into a former acquaintance at the bar, and 3 weeks later, he proposed.
That was flattering to me, and I always had this great crush on him, so I just knew it was the right thing to do. So I married him, and I got pregnant. I got my other son back, so, you know, I had a happy home.
In 1995, Shelby had another son. She finally felt her life was turning around, until she caught her husband doing drugs.
Being on the rebound, now I've got two. No education, all I can do is dance.
The struggle of trying to keep their heads above water financially got back to her. She started using drugs again.
So I started doing the heroin. Once you start, it's not like cocaine and it's not like marijuana. You can't put it down.
Because of her heroin use, Shelby could no longer get jobs dancing.
Well, I run into a girl who said, well, you know, I got the perfect job for you. You know, I'm working for this escort agency. It's, you know, $150 just to walk in the door, and it's good money.
She used to tell me, I can't support two kids myself flipping burgers at McDonald's. But it wasn't really something that she wanted to do. It was something that she had to do.
There was not one time that I knocked on a door that I wasn't standing there holding my breath. You know, but the money is a lure. There were some jobs you go in and you stay an hour, you'd leave $250.
Shelby stuck to a policy when it came to partying with clients.
I always had the golden rule of I didn't get high with customers. If I'd have stuck to that rule, I would not be sitting in this chair today.
On December 11th, 2003, Shelby Carano would break her golden rule. It would cost her her freedom, and it would cost her client his life. Next up on Women Behind Bars.
Wrong place, wrong choices. Sad situation, but a man died.
And I told them, I'm not a murderer. You know, I don't have a violent bone in my body.
By 2003, 38-year-old Shelby Carano had battled drug addiction for more than half her life. She turned to prostitution by joining an escort service to support her kids and the heroin habit that consumed her.
One night, a gentleman called, and I went over to see him, and he was a very nice man.
Shelby's new client was 43-year-old Stanley McMillan, who worked for a reforestation company. He was staying at a motel just outside Richmond, Virginia.
We had experienced a hurricane in September, and there were many people who came from neighboring states to help with the cleanup, and as I understand, that's what Mr. McMillan was doing.
We did what you do in escort service. He noticed a track mark on my arm, and he said, "Wow, you get high? Well, can you get me some drugs?" And I was like, "We'll talk about this later." So I tricked with him, and I made my money.
She had already, you know, performed the acts that he asked for, and then he said, "Would you go get drugs?"
Despite Shelby's personal rule not to get high with clients, she agreed.
He was a nice person. I think that's what made me say yes.
So he gave her the money to go and buy heroin. And she went to her supplier.
It was very late, probably 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, it's not a good time to go in the projects. Well, I got robbed.
The next afternoon, she called Stanley to apologize for not returning with the drugs.
When I got robbed, they had taken the agency's money as well as mine. So now I'm in the hole. So he gave me the money to pay my debt to my boss and said, "Go get me some right now and come straight back." So I did. I went and I got, not a lot, 3 eggs of heroin. So I worked him up one in a spoon, I worked me one up in a spoon, and I was getting ready to do mine. He said, "Well, can you hit me?"
Shelby injected the heroin into Stanley's arm for him. She says this is a common practice among intravenous drug users.
We got high, and he sat there for a few minutes. He said, "That was really good."
She said that in a little while, he wanted some more.
He had tracks up and down his arms. So in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, he was older than me. He was in his 40s. Then he knew what he was doing. So when he said, "I want to do another one," I didn't even second guess it.
After the second hit of heroin, Stanley's actions seemed impaired.
He got up, he walked around the bed, and he walked into the wall. And I jumped up and I ran over to him and I said, "Hey man, are you all right?" He said, yeah, I'll be all right." He kind of pushed me away.
That's what heroin does to you. It makes you get this euphoric high. It can make you look as though you're unconscious for a bit. And it seemed normal.
I put my hand underneath his nose. He was breathing. I went and got a wet rag. I wiped his face because he was sweating. He was snoring.
And she felt like she could leave because he just needed to sleep it off. Those were her words.
Shelby maintained Stanley was alive and sleeping when she left the motel. Several hours later, around 4 a.m., Stanley's roommate returned and found the 43-year-old dead on the floor.
This gentleman had gone next door at his request, knowing that he was expecting company.
The roommate called the police, who arrived on the scene soon after. While checking the phone records for Stanley's room, officers discovered an outgoing call to a number registered to Shelby Carano. Shelby, meanwhile, was with another client.
Well, I was in the middle of, you know, spending time with this guy. The phone rang. It was the police. What I was thinking was I was getting ready to go to jail for prostitution. Boy, was I wrong.
Later that morning, Shelby met with detectives at the motel where she was living.
They wanted to know, could they search the room? And I told them, yeah. The first thing he finds is the needle. And he was like, "Well, what was in it?" I said, "Heroin." And he said, "Well, you know you're going to jail."
Carano was brought to Chesterfield County Police Headquarters for questioning.
I still wasn't aware that he was dead. I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Shelby had no attorney present, and she was so terrified and intimidated.
At first, Shelby denied being at the motel with the victim.
I tried to say, you know, that I wasn't there just because I was scared. And, you know, finally I was like, okay, look, this is it. This is what happened. And I told them, I'm not a murderer. I don't have a violent bone in my body.
Then the autopsy report was completed.
The autopsy showed that he did indeed die of an acute heroin overdose.
Some experts believe that the amount of heroin considered to cause death from acute heroin intoxication could vary from person to person, depending on that person's tolerance to the drug and environmental factors when injecting the heroin. Shelby was brought to Riverside Regional Jail, where she was charged with distribution of heroin and second-degree murder.
Shelby called me on the phone, and I said, boy, you've done it this time. They're going to make an example of you, Shelby.
I was very scared. I really didn't know what to expect. I've never been through such a trial.
We heard that, yes, indeed, she did bring them to Stanley McMillan. She did inject them to him. She did see that he was in distress. She did leave the scene without calling for help. That was pretty much the prosecution.
The medical examiner said that there were signs that this wasn't a first experience with drugs.
On October 19th, after one day of testimony, Shelby's fate was in the hands of the jury.
And in considering all of the other evidence, he died of an acute heroin intoxication. It just didn't leave much doubt.
After an hour, the jury returned with its verdict: guilty for distribution of heroin and guilty of second-degree murder. During the sentencing phase of the proceedings, the victim's family took the stand.
This was the one person we couldn't hear from. Mr. McMillan could not tell us his side. And so it was difficult to see his family, with those horrible circumstances.
It's very unfortunate that anyone ever has to lose someone because of something as idiotic as drug use. My heart goes out to the family of the man. They lost a loved one.
No one on the jury felt that she had done it intentionally. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong choices. Sad situation, but a man died. She was responsible for that.
When the judge said 16 years, you know, it just took my breath away. It just seems unfair that they can blame one adult, one junkie, so to speak, for another junkie's actions.
Shelby Carano is currently serving her sentence at a maximum security prison in Virginia.
If I were not here today, I would be dead. The heroin would have took me out. This prison time saved my life. Since my incarceration, I finally got that GED.
She's already tutoring other inmates on what it can do to you if you get addicted to the drugs.
I guess everything happens for a reason in life, and I'm sorry that, you know, that Stanley died. But in hindsight of it now, and I'm gonna try to make a difference for somebody, so another person doesn't die.